Support for this program is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
The Local Thread.
Welcome back to A Moment of Truth. I am the Sojourner Truth reporter, Alexandria Leatherberry. I am so glad to be back to discuss community solutions to Black health epidemics. Last episode, we focused on the physical body and preventative care measures. Today, we are here to continue the discussion beyond the physical body. As I continue my personal health journey, along with diving deeper into public health service, it is undeniable that mental health is becoming a prevalent topic when it comes to Black health. The Black community has historically undergone consistent mass trauma that has impacted the community's economical, physical, and social emotional health. For years, the Black community has navigated their trauma by way of perseverance. What is celebrated as Black resilience includes a pattern of surviving repeated social and racial trauma with limited space to heal. Whether it is putting it in the music from hymns that led us to freedom or paying tithes Sunday as a deposit to that biblical salvation, Black people found a way to survive that trauma before, after, and when it came. As we continue to advance, we understand that surviving as a community won't be sustainable without better care for our health, which is why it's no surprise mental health has to enter the chat. With the understanding of the long-term effects of trauma, we have to address this. However, I find it interesting that as we bring clinical mental health care to the forefront, we see more narratives of it being said that spirituality has been a crutch or even an aid into the mental health disparities that we see in the Black community. However, I want to explore the conversation of it being a foundational component that has been a part of the building blocks of holistic wellness as we know today. I am here with two women that have built therapy practices on using these spiritual tools. I have Kimberly Polam and LaShawna Alfred here today. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You both are owners in your own right of your mental health institutions or practices. And I just wanted to first start off with getting your background and how you guys came together.
I am the owner of You Change Behavioral Health. And I met Kimberly when we were working at another organization. And so in our life just happened to where we end up connecting and partnering as we continue on our mission of helping individuals, you know, gain the skills needed to heal, you know, trauma and mental health.
As LaShawna stated, our paths have crossed as spiritual sisters, as business owners. I am the owner of Peaceful Pathways, LLC. And LaShawna and I have worked together professionally and personally, just doing our best to bring awareness of mental and emotional health and wellness to our community for some years now.
When you say gaining skills, what type of skills do you specifically focus on in your practice?
Yeah, so it really is like life skills, right? And not just life skills, but skills to help you manage and identify, you know, beliefs that's actually keeping you stuck, whether it's in relationships, you know, in your mental health. But it's all boiled down to a set of beliefs, right? And what mm-hmm. we make meaningful to us.
Exactly. Like LaShawna stated, you know, we really focus on looking at, okay, what are some of the strengths? What are some of the core values that people come to us with searching for assistance with mental health or emotional health issues, and building from there? You know, as a community, we know that we are very resilient. However, there's nothing wrong with getting some professional expertise, help, and assistance, and fostering that sense of community is something that You Change and Peaceful Pathways hold in strong priority.
Absolutely. I really like what you guys touched on as far as those life skills and identifying beliefs and values. That can really be kind of almost the bottom line to what you are kind of contributing to your health. What are some ways that you have found that in your practice, like I noticed, Kimberly, you focus on like maybe behavioral health therapy. How have you found that has different from traditional, maybe like clinical practices?
So what you're directly speaking to and a primary focus, aside from, as LaShawna stated, we work in conjunction with one another on the mental health side with You Change Behavioral Health, one of the things that I recognized with that helped me to birth Peaceful Pathways is that not everyone dealing with an emotional health crisis has a mental health diagnosis. So therefore, being able to build on and focusing what are these life things that we're going through, particularly as a community, a focus on women's health, professionals in health who don't typically want to seek treatment, or, you know, we have that bias and those barriers to accepting that we may need help. So really focusing on what are those things that are keeping us from reaching our fullest potential. And it's inherently inside of us a lot of times, but we really focus upon, okay, where are you now? How has your past kind of molded you to be the person you are now, and where are you trying to go? So that's one of the things that I really focus on in my practice with clients, understanding our past and how can we utilize the resources within our community, within our professional systems to build and move forward to being healthier and whole.
Absolutely. LaShonda, did you want to add to that at all?
No, she did great.
I don't know. Absolutely. I want to go back to the point and like what you said about that bias against diagnosis. Mm-hmm. How do you, I guess, navigate that in your professions? And when you see that bias, although that, you know, your crisis doesn't necessarily equal that, I definitely identify with that. But when do you make that transition that this might be a little bit deeper?
Wow. Yeah. I think when looking at the symptoms, right, like the length of time, how it's affecting a person's day-to-day life, and then we have to really be able to see it. And really moving or trying to remove the stigma off of mental health, right? Because even when we're talking about the diagnosis, it really just helps us understand what is actually happening so you're not thinking something is wrong with you. And so even changing the mindset around the diagnosis is very important as well. And so one of the ways I do that, I show up on social media as a therapist. I'm very transparent in, you know, my life journey. And a lot of times just being open and transparent to help other individuals feel comfortable with sharing where they are. Because the reality is, I believe in our community, and this is just what I always say, in our community, all of us have PTSD. You know, when you think about the stuff that has happened, but not all of us are willing to accept it or even recognize it, right?
Absolutely. They do say, like, almost everyone's going to experience some form of trauma throughout their lifetime. And I definitely agree to what you said. Sometimes that diagnosis can just be that starting point in understanding, like, okay, I do need to take better care of myself. Mm-hmm. I actually have been clinically diagnosed with depression and having chronic depression. And, you know, some people are like, why don't you get on medication and things like that? I guess contributed to my grandfather. I'm like, he used to have a book of like at home remedies for like every sickness you could have. Yeah. So I guess my natural instinct was to turn to that. Like, what are some remedies I could do at home? And it wasn't denying that I needed clinical care. I just set up a consultation with the therapist the other day because I'm like, I'm in crisis mode.
Yeah.
But it's like, I now, it's almost like having that fire escape plan because it's like, I know what steps I need to do when I'm like, I identify those different feelings.
Yeah. But like what you just said, right? And recognizing how some of the ways you see life now and how you navigate through it hasn't been influenced by, you know, your grandfather and different, you know, individuals that you were in contact with. And I think that's a lot of things, even when we get into, you know, just as like religion and people saying just pray and, you know, all of that stuff. So it's a lot of misinformation. And the information that we get is really in the way whether we get the help that we need or we suffer in silence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And going back to your question of, you know, how do you differentiate between that mental health diagnosis and an emotional crisis? One of the things that LaShonda and I think this is why we work so well and have so well over the years, is we are very open and transparent to all areas of help and being able to utilize those clinical skills to be able to say, okay, you know what, this is someone that I'm working with, and maybe initially I didn't see a mental health diagnosis. Maybe we're working on some life transition and adaptation things, and in that process I began to realize, you know what, this is a little bit deeper. You know, I'm noticing some compulsive behaviors. I'm noticing that this person has gone from not wanting to socialize to not being able to socialize. And then being able to say, okay, you know what, not closing the door on one area of help, but less, how can we work in collaboration? How can we work with some therapeutic coaching as well as some mental health therapy? Yes. And tapping into, which our community has always been strong, our spiritual community.
Yes.
How can we work in collaboration with these things? And I like what Lashana said about part of the stigma over the years has been due to misinformation, mm-hmm. you know, due to that thought of, I don't want something to be wrong with me, or I don't want people to feel like I have a problem, when the reality is we all have problems. It's how we deal with them. And do we have that support in dealing with those things? So we really, really strive to lower those stigma and just to be open and work in collaboration, not just with one another, but with other providers within our community.
I definitely agree. And I definitely like that you brought up the fact about even understanding the background or traditionally just how somebody has grown up and things like that. Mm-hmm. I think that brings that culturally, like, just awareness and responsiveness to know how to best treat someone. So how do you guys, like, you know, approach? Is it like kind of from your personal experience and things like that, or has the professional training and things like that help you identify how those cultural differences just might be influencing how they're approaching addressing their mental health?
I would say a little bit of both. As Black women, you know, raised in Black families and Black communities, you know, you grow up with the what happens in the house stays in the house. You grow up with the, you know, you had family members or people in your neighborhoods that no one quite knew exactly what was wrong with them, but something wasn't quite right, but nobody talked about it.
Mm-hmm.
So being able to come from that vantage point and then, you know, growing up, working in the field, becoming educated in this, being able to see that. And once we recognize those barriers, recognize those stigmas, taking an active role in doing something about it, you know, being able to normalize. That's what you're speaking about, normalizing mental health and mental health awareness, and that it's not shame based. It doesn't have to be embarrassment based. You know, we pride ourselves on working in a no judgment zone because we all come from something. We all come from something.
Yeah. And just as I'm listening to Kimberly and her response, it brought me to just this whole idea, right, of the cultural aspect in when we're talking about domestic violence. You know, again, when we're talking about the way we survive, I didn't hear anything about domestic violence until, you know, I was full grown, you know, and I'm thinking like, okay, so something as simple as that is cultural, right? Because again, what may seem like an issue for somebody else, it's a survival tactic, mm-hmm. you know, for someone else. And so, yes, we're bringing our knowledge, our experience, you know, our wisdom, you know, and all of that to the area. And then also I find myself in positions where I'm doing cultural sensitivity and awareness training as well.
I definitely agree to those survival tactics. A lot of times, like, you can end up defensive kind of almost unknowingly. It's your self-conscious just trying to protect itself from being in those same predicaments that you have been before. What are some of those, like, survival tactics or responses that you have seen that maybe have been labeled as, like, a mental health disorder?
Isolation. I would say depression and depressive symptoms, whether we're talking about depression diagnostically or depressive symptoms and depression in a way we navigate the world. And those, when you talk about especially those survival techniques, a lot of times what we see as particularly people in our community, you know, you hear the term angry Black woman or angry Black man. When a lot of times, you know, it's that it's not just I'm trying to be defensive, I'm trying to be combative, but this has been how I've learned to protect myself and navigate the world. So we see a lot of that, and we really work to get to the root cause of that so that we learn how to navigate and we learn how to move and succeed in our world in a different way that doesn't have to be perceived as just this person just doesn't want help, or this is how I've always been, or this is how they've always been. And being able to see that and recognize it and say, you know what you're experiencing, it isn't so abnormal, but how can we take those same defense mechanisms and turn them around into a strength? How can we take that same train of thought that makes you feel like it's you against the world and understand that what you're really dealing with is how can I navigate the world, not just based on how I was brought up, but taking those things from how I was brought up and making them into a positive?
Yeah. Another thing, when we're looking at children, right, you may see a child who, or a lot of Black boys have been, you know, overdiagnosed with ADHD, right? And so you may be looking at it like, okay, this kid just can't be still, just can't, you know, stop talking or whatever, but you don't know the family dynamics. And so just really looking at that. So that psychosocial assessment is very important as we're gathering information so we can be able to see and connect the dots and not just look at, you know, a particular behavior and now saying this is the diagnosis, slapping a diagnosis on it, but really looking at the whole, the totality, you know, of this child. So just say if a child is at school and they're not participating, well, they couldn't sleep, right? Maybe they heard their mom and boyfriend or somebody, you know, maybe they heard gunshots, you know, that's prevalent in our communities now. And now we want them to go to school and pay attention. Like, come on, we got to, you know, we have to really pay attention to how we're treating our children. Right. Because those children grow up to be adults. And now those adults are judged because we think they should know better. But I'm in the guise of how do I know better if nobody taught me better?
I have come to the point in that I'm responsible for identifying my triggers and being able to manage those. But my experiences are valid. Mm-hmm. And having that understanding and knowing that you have a safe space to be able to be understood is important and will allow for that open relationship with you and your clinical therapist. So I thank you guys for joining me today. We're going to wrap up this part of the conversation. I hope that we leave with the thought that spirituality has definitely been a refuge for Black Americans, and clinical care does offer those tools so to be included. So maybe it's not choosing one or the other, but to understand how we can collaborate. We'll be right back with a moment of truth. Welcome back to A Moment of Truth. I am the Sojourner Truth reporter, Alexandra Leatherberry, and I am still here with Kimberly of Peaceful Pathways and Lashana of You Change. For this segment, we have also have District 41 State Representative Erica White to join us. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you. I'm proud to be here.
In the last segment, we discussed the idea of spiritual care being a building block in mental health care. I want to continue the conversation with you, State Rep, here today, to explore how that shift could bring stronger community foundations through our leadership. I believe this is especially important as we are feeling the impacts of uncertain and extreme policy changes. The gleaming response to that right now seems to be gathering with your neighbors. State Rep White is a champion for her neighborhoods, ensuring she is boots on the ground face-to-face with her neighborhoods. Not only does she ensure she brings the current and accurate information so they make informed decisions, she has not sat still since taking her seat in 2025, but she is here to take a moment of truth with us today. I want to discuss how important it is to open our minds and how we work together to ensure communities' wellness and that the programs that often do the jobs of policies are mobilized to shift community adjacency for policy change. State Rep, I went to your training, and I just want to start with what your experience has been like in Columbus since you've been in your seat.
It has been much different to be a legislator than it is to be an activist. And if I were to share with anyone, because I hope that many people still think about being more than a voter and be more engaged beyond that. To be an activist means that you have a lot more room to be able to speak truth to power. To be a legislator means I depend on you to be an activist to allow me to do the work to make your truth to power something that we can put in writing that actually moves your words into law, into legislation. And so though when I'm on the floor, it's more formal, and I miss parts of that. I do miss being more of an activist, but I'm sent there to represent from my community to be a legislator. So you do, that is one of the big differences. And I think the other is that you have this, it's, I don't want to say it's a sports team, but you are there. You're to represent. Speak for, be on the floor for the people who sent you there. So while you're there with legislators from all across the state, from even people that are from different parts, even within your community, you're supposed to come together and build things together from different parts of Lucas County, different parts of Northwest Ohio, and different parts of Ohio. But there are times where I have to say, I really am concerned about the health of Lake Erie because we live by Lake Erie, where I'm concerned about how the Gordon Howdy Bridge? I should know this. Where I've been very busy, so. But how that bridge or transportation for this part of the state, in simple words, how is that going to affect how we survive or how our commerce is or how people feel in where we live in Northwest Ohio, which is very different from Southeast or Southwest Ohio. But how still do we fit into all of that? And so when you're talking about spiritual health or mental health or even community health, what does that look like for us and being the voice and the representation and remembering that I'm there to represent the voices here and how those voices fit into the state overall?
And can you just share some things that you have been doing to ensure that you are, you know, hearing those voices and anything that you can maybe share about, like, how you're seeing activism influence what is happening in our neighborhoods today?
As far as connecting with the voices in my neighborhood, you would think that it's a lot easier than it is, and it is. One of the easiest things to do is to go to the grocery store, to pump gas, and to go to church, to show up to school games, to even be out shoveling your snow. So we have come to think that only knocking on doors or only being very political and being an elected official is how we actually engage or connect with people. But if you think about it, voters and people in your community are just everyday folks. They're trying to figure out how to pay bills. They're trying to figure out how to balance budgets. They're trying to figure out what the heck is going on, you know? And so they want to meet you in a very relaxed environment. They want to run up with you in a grocery store when you're trying to figure out why you're also paying $4 for your favorite loaf of bread. And is it worth it for your thighs or not? You know, so you're having the same thoughts as everyone in your community. And that is the best way to stay connected with your community is to remember that you are part of that community and you're not separate. And but you're in leadership in a way that people are coming to you with their concerns and questions. They realize that they can have a very real conversation with you and they don't have to have all the ers and ings at the end of words. And what I mean by that is they don't have to speak in a specific language or use perfect English. They can just talk to you in real talk and they can have real problems and you can understand them. So connecting with the community, also having training sessions. So the one you came to was a prototype that I put together was to teach people how to write op-eds. What is it like to come down and do testimony, either written testimony or in person? We also, I put together a training on how to claim your unclaimed funds. And so it is listening to people in the community, knowing what they want to learn about, connecting with them, but realizing that I am not the holder of all things. You know, I am not Frodo. And I do not have all the answers. I'm not on a quest. There are people in the community also who have really great resources for other people to connect with. So my job is also to connect with people in the community, with other people in the community that can help. And then you said, how do I see that influence in our neighborhoods? I think you asked.
Yeah, activism today.
Activism with our neighborhoods. I'll tell you, it's changed. And I just had a conversation. I'll just say his first name. The gentleman named Art, who works as an educator in post-secondary education. And here's someone that's highly educated and said, you know, I don't want to just give money anymore. I just don't want to do these topical types of engagement with people who are elected officials or running for office. I want to talk to my neighbors. I want to find out what's happening. I want to go out and tell them why it's important about public education, why public radio, why things that are provided through the public good support the public overall, why we should do these things. And he said, I want to go out and find out why my neighbors are angry, what's going on, how do they feel about mental health? Because I might not know the person three or four blocks over, but I know the person that lives on either side of me or across the street. And so this is a good, safe place to have conversations, or not. You know, you may be the person two or three doors down, but we do know our neighbors. And these conversations, this is how we start to change the environment we're in, because if we don't like, you're right, if we don't like where we are, then we have to change ourselves, and we change ourselves first, and then we can step out and start our conversations and change others. But that doesn't start unless we know the community we're in, and we start to reach out to others. So I've seen just really down all the way back to neighbor, door to door, and reaching out to the people that are right next to you. We're not reaching up, we're not reaching out, we're reaching right next door to the person that's next to us.
Those are great points, Erica, and I definitely believe this is a political or climate or just even social time that we need that. And I appreciate you mentioning the church being a point of connection that we've seen in our communities. As we know, that's kind of the largest institution that we have for spirituality, right? Yes. There are other ways that we can practice outside of that and things like that, but we know that's a home where a lot of people take their practice. And again, you mentioned that place that people are comfortable. Like, you know, when we go to church, we're shouting, we're falling out, crying. And that really, I feel like once I just really got deeper into what I needed to be able to start healing from my trauma and just actually, like I said, navigating things like clinical depression, I needed to cry. I needed that space. And I was like, oh, maybe church is like a little bit of that, you know, everyday access that I have to just that counseling or support, that community support and connection. But something interesting that I have been experiencing since I recently moved to Flint, Michigan, is seeing churches really step into the space of mental health care. They're partnering with like Genesee County Health Systems to be able to provide programming and services to their members. And so, you know, they have come up with like these robust programs of, you know, you can find, you know, community closets, and some of them do like prevention programming as far as support groups for families that might be dealing with substance abuse and things like that in our communities that we know could affect mental health. And I just thought that was interesting because we sometimes, like I said, want to separate the two, but I thought it was very interesting in how they were including that a part of it. And we were moving that stigma that we talk about, right, about mental health and recognizing that this is something that their members are experiencing. And I guess it also brings the question to mind in how we can maybe shift some of the inclusion stigma when it comes to church, right? We've heard of like, you know, church hurt and things like that. So what kind of would that look like to you guys in like, starting that conversation about if somebody needed some type of servicing and we know that the resources might be available in something like a spiritual institution, how do we approach those conversations?
I think a big part of that is really stressing and opening arms and building those bridges so that our spiritual community, you know, right here in Toledo, in Lucas County, sees the mental health community as an ally, not an adversary. You know, I think we can all attest to years ago, you know, growing up, and let's be real, within our community, a lot of times when it came to mental health or mental health issues, people were told, you know, just pray about it, just pray about it, and it'll be okay, you know, and to not seek out. You know, again, being very transparent, mental health and mental health assistance on a formal level was something that our Caucasian counterparts did. So within the Black community, you go to church, you pray, you have somebody lay their hands on you, and it's supposed to be okay. What we can do today is for our churches, our spiritual community, to really see the mental health system. And I do believe we're doing a good job of that right now. Many of our churches, many of our congregations are opening the door and open their ears and programs to mental health services within the church, being able to say, okay, you know what? Prayer and therapy works. Prayer and therapy works. Mm-hmm. So a big part of that, Alexandria, I believe, is to consistently show the spiritual community that we are an ally, not an adversary, and being able to work in collaboration, not making people feel like they have to pick and choose between church and therapy, but understanding that one of the things that we really stress is holistic care. So when you're talking about holistic, we're talking about mentally, spiritually, emotionally, financially, within the family system, within your places of employment. So bridging that gap really begins to look as it should when we collaborate.
What I'm curious, Erica, maybe in some ways that you have maybe seen out in the community, just through your experience, of ways that churches or, you know, spiritual leadership may be addressing spirituality as a component of well-being rather than more institutionalized religious tradition.
So what I've seen is that, and that's one of the parts I wanted to bring up too, is more of a care team. Mm-hmm. And so in community, churches can definitely take the point where we expand the care team, because when we look at mental health, and as someone who has a family member directly that experienced mental health, and I'll say that we can always think back to a couple of generations ago when someone always say, "Oh, that's my Uncle Jimmy," you know, or "this uncle, they're just kind of, you're crazy," or "this is our aunt such as, she just is kind, she's a little off." But we never really, especially in many families, directly addressed what did that mean. Is this person bipolar? Are they dealing with postpartum depression? Do they have something clinically going on? We just said used terms that were just very derogatory. And so when we think about when the church has evolved, or spirituality evolves, and it starts to say, hey, there's something really that we can tap in and we can expand our care to help people, we have a better chance of taking care of people, not just mentally, not just physically, but also the spiritual health and well-being. And we look at like clinicians, peers, families, and those faith community leaders. People have more doors, and the more doors that are open, the more doors that are helpful for people, the more chances we have in helping people manage their mental health.
And absolutely want to kind of toss this ball to Lashana a bit, as Lashana is a licensed clinician as mm-hmm. well as a licensed minister. So Lashana,
she has doors open, right?
Yeah, share some of your yes. expertise in this area right with you. Us. We would be remiss not to have you jump in.
Yes. Okay. So yes, I am a leader in the church as well as a licensed therapist. And one of the things, I mean, just in the aspect of blending that is educating the community in the church as well as the community that we work with, the collaboration part in that. I like what Representative White said, in the space of you being on the ground, you know, and advocating, to now being a rep, you know, and just the frustration that can be even come around that if you don't see the community actually doing, you know, doing maybe what you once was doing, so you can now do the work that you do now, and just the how that can mess with, you know, our emotional well-being, our mental health. And so I like the whole collaboration thing, making sure the churches, and like Kimberly said, I absolutely believe that is taking place. I see now pastors blending their message, their sermon, bringing in that mental health aspect. And so I believe we're headed in the right direction.
Absolutely. I agree. I definitely appreciate you joining us here today, State Rep. And I thank you, Kimberly and Lashana, hanging in with me today. This conversation was important because when legislators and community leaders are involved in conversations, programs evolve into movements. Movements can influence policy change, and we're going to continue to discuss more about this in our next segment. Welcome back to A Moment of Truth. I am Sojourner Truth reporter Alexandria Leatherberry, and I'm still here with Kimberly and Lashana. For this segment, we also have clinical mental health therapist Bernadette Joy Graham. Thank you for joining us today, Bernadette.
I'm happy to be here.
As conversations around mental health continue to evolve, so does the question of where spirituality fits within that framework. For Black communities, spiritual practice has been attached to emotional survival. It has shaped how we process grief, celebrate joy, confront injustice, and make meaning of suffering. Yet, as clinical mental health care becomes more accessible and more normalized, there is sometimes tension around how these two worlds maybe can collaborate or intersect. In this discussion, we want to move beyond the idea of competition and explore that collaboration. Bernadette, you are a clinical mental health therapist, but also have made some interesting points as we prepared for today's discussion and how we should approach things and when it comes to Black mental health. One thing I like that you said was that mental health is what has happened to you. I resonate with that. And I wanted to start with what led you to pursue work in the mental health field.
Actually, what led me to the mental health world, my mother passed away when I was 14. I was a freshman in high school, and she died suddenly. That really threw me over the top as a teenager. And so I didn't grieve. Back in the 80s, there was no mental health, especially for the Black community. So it was like, just go back to school and forget about it. So after high school, went to the military. Years later, went into college back in the stateside and started taking psychology courses, even though I was pre-med. And I had a college professor that said, you know, you'd make a great therapist. And I'm like, what? And so I started to get more into it, and I just went into grad school, and I realized they weren't teaching grief, spirituality, religion, anything like that in the counseling courses. They were electives, but there wasn't anything to it. And I was really angry about it, and I actually got a division and interest network put into the American Counseling Association after graduate school, and I had to take specialized courses after that in grief and bereavement. To answer your question directly, had my mother not passed away, I don't know what I would have went into. But I always tell people, it's not the question of why someone died, but you'll know the reason eventually in your lifetime. And now I know the reason why my mother passed away, and that's a spiritual component to me personally.
Understanding that why things happen, I think, is kind of, it's that spiritual testimony that we talk about, and like, we will understand later in life, and why we might have had endured things. I appreciate you sharing that. And I also wanted to go back to when you said that you noticed those gaps in your education and not touching on spirituality. Why was that important to you? And what did you think that, you know, would be some ways that you would want to better address or fill those gaps?
Well, anytime anyone comes to counseling, therapy, they're coming for help for some reason. They've lost something, whether it was a person or finances or a relationship. And not everyone is religious or spiritual or can call themselves a Christian. So you don't push that onto them. But when we were going through like our role playing and courses and so forth, it wasn't adding up for me. Something was missing. And it was like, okay, we have the clinical piece. We can build coping skills all day long. We can do the evidence-based interventions. But there were still people, especially during like my internships, that something wasn't there. And so that's what brought it out for me. And I started thinking about it and started researching it on my own. And then it became personalized for me, like I said, thinking about my mother's loss. And I was like, okay, I have to go back to the spirituality part of my own self on this. And so that's what kind of the pieces were missing. And I was like, we were always taught to think outside the box. And hey, I was thinking outside the box, and it did it for me.
I want to pass this question a little bit, follow up on that with Lashana and Kimberly here, in thinking outside the box. You know, how, especially you, Lashana, as a minister, how do you stay rooted in like who you are and your values and that spirituality, but like she said, not pressuring, you know, your beliefs or putting your beliefs on someone else?
Yeah, I actually teach a 5-step framework, you know, on this, and the first pillar is spirituality. So when I think about spirituality, as I'm defining it, not just for my life, but those who I work with, it's really about our identity, right, and the meaning. And so when individuals are suffering with mental health and maybe depression or, you know, anxiety, it's because of the meaning they put on the different life events. And so when we're blending that spirituality and mental health together, it's really shifting the meaning, you know. And so I've been able to, I believe, seamlessly do that because I don't push a certain belief on individuals. You know, I just help them identify, you know, who they are, right? And how they can begin to create new meaning around, you know, life experiences.
I agree with everything that Lashana and Bernadette stated as well. A lot of times we have clients coming to us, and from the mental health aspect, one of the things that we know, you know, meeting a client where they're at, building that rapport. And for me, when it comes to spirituality and weaving that into the practice and working with mental health clients, is really about mental and emotional health. It's really about seeing where that client is at. As Bernadette stated, not trying to force my beliefs on them, but seeing where they're at spiritually and gaining that understanding and what they're seeking. Sometimes I'll have individuals come to me, and one of the questions that they ask or that they already know about me from other people I've worked with or what they've seen or who they've interact with that have had interactions with me is where is my spiritual grounding? And I'm very open and transparent about that, and also knowing that the basis of what I believe doesn't have to influence the basis of what you believe, but educating ourselves and being able to say, okay, you know what, if the spiritual component is something that you welcome and you want in your sessions and in this healing journey, then let's meet at a common ground on that. Another thing for me is I believe that it is important that we as the providers have an understanding. So, you know, being able to say, all right, I've done my homework. If you come to me and you let me know that that spiritual connection is also important to you, then I come prepared to the sessions to meet you where you are, regardless to what your belief system is. We all don't have the same belief systems, but I'm able to say, okay, you know what? You come from a spiritual background of Christianity, and you would like scripture and Bible incorporated into how I'm teaching you and helping you with navigating the world. Okay, you know what? You're dealing with anxiety. Philippians talks directly to that. Be anxious for nothing. You know, maybe it's not the Bible. Maybe it's the Quran. The Quran addresses depression. Hardship is not permanent. Allah assists the brokenhearted. He's never far away. So we have a responsibility as well to educate and open ourselves up to meet our clients where they are spiritually to best help them move forward in their healing.
Definitely a mutual meeting point of meeting where they are and identifying those needs accurately. Bernadette, as we prepare for this conversation, you mentioned that there was a difference between counseling and therapy. And I definitely, you know, would like to just learn a little bit about what you meant by that, because I definitely can see some of that and how that might differentiate in that clinical space versus the spiritual space.
So counseling, they're used interchangeably, and it depends on the therapist and the provider. Counseling is sort of like you come in and say, do I want to go to college? Do I want to get married? You know, choices that aren't so, they're permanent in your life if you want to get married, but it's just processing it. It's not like, do I have depression? Do I have anxiety? Do I have PTSD? It's not so much a diagnosis. Therapy, on the other hand, is work. It's like going to physical therapy. And so you get homework assignments, you get interventions, you get a treatment plan. So when you come back to the next session, you build off of that, and you, because no one wants to be in therapy forever. And you build a relationship with the therapist, counselor, so to speak, because when life happens, you don't want to go to your first assessment and not know the person, because you need to build a relationship with that person. So I always tell people, get a therapist, build a relationship with that therapist, and keep that number under on speed dial under your lawyer, because you might need them at the same time. So the counseling is more so, no, there's not really nothing serious going on right now. No one's died. You know, I wasn't in a car accident, nothing like that. But I found a therapist. We're building a relationship. We're talking about things. And then when life does happen, you can call that person right away and get your appointment in right away without having to do all the paperwork and going through all that, and you can get there quicker. So therapy, like I said, is all, on the other hand, is more work involved. You want to make progress. You might go from going to a therapy session every week to every 2 weeks to once a month. And then when you need them, you might not call them for 6 months at a time when life happens. So that's the difference there.
That's very interesting. I'm just noticing how I appreciate the answer, right? Because I am a therapist who use it interchangeably. But when you just said it, I'm sitting here intrigued, like, oh, yeah, tell me, right? Tell me the difference. So that's interesting. Kimberly, did you notice, did you have a difference, or did you use those interchangeably as well?
You know what? I use them interchangeably as well, but I like the way that mm-hmm. Bernadette kind of defined them differently from a different aspect. Mm-hmm. So absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was along the lines I was thinking. It seems like counseling would be that relationship. When I think about even when you maybe, you know, in the spiritual space, you go to counseling to maybe for your pastor and things like that, but it's not as formative as you would experience in a clinical space. I think that is just interesting in how you can kind of maybe sometimes even receive the same outcome in the avenue that you would take or you feel more comfortable with. So depending on the avenue that you choose, you know, it is kind of like you could still end up with the same outcome. So I do find that interesting that you, like, you know, differentiated those two in that way, because a lot of times we do just honestly just use them as that same word. But I do think there's a difference in comfortability, connection, and just where you might, you know, be able to open up more and really get the results that you're looking for. Something else that you have mentioned as far as that is just influential, and it definitely, I think, resonates on that level of what we experience as church is the music, right? That is like, especially in the Black church, if the music not right, we probably go, oh, no, I'm just kidding. Don't tune out. But we are, you know, music is definitely so influential. Even in my spiritual journey, I have started like, maybe I should change what I listen to a little bit more because of the things they're saying and putting on my mind. Bernadette, could you share more about how you have kind of addressed this, or like, how do you use music in your therapy sessions, or you have found it even in therapy practices for you?
Some of my education, and when I was working on my PhD, you know, we have to do these long, drawn-out, two-hour presentations. And so one of my presentations, I actually used Kendrick Lamar. And Kendrick Lamar is a rap artist, a very good rap artist, in my opinion. And if you listen to his words, he speaks about how he tried to kill himself multiple times. The devil tried to put him in a bow tie. I mean, his words are very profound. So he's actually coming out. He's not embarrassed about it anymore. And I hear that in a lot of rap songs these days and a lot of R&B songs. And there are a huge list of rappers these days that only speak about mental health or Christianity or spirituality together. And it's like amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, same. You can dance to it just like you can dance to Snoop Dogg, you know. But I find that music is very influential, especially in today's generation. The words that they're hearing is putting an impression on their minds. And when you put something on your mind, then it affects your body and your behavior and so forth. I love the fact that these artists are coming out and actually sharing their personal experiences of mental health through music and through their professions to spread the message that mental health is okay, because we listen to them.
Yes.
It's like you will listen to a celebrity before you listen to your doctor sometimes.
And I agree, because there's always been, especially when you start bringing, like, you know, talking about, you know, spirituality into music, it always has been kind of the don't, you know, of, you know, bringing in the secular world into, like, spiritual music. But it's like, aren't we, like, this the secular population, those are the regular people, right? That if you are, you know, identify with, you know, some type of religion, like those are the people that you are trying to, I guess, connect with, right? So I always found that confusing, and like, why wouldn't you kind of want to mention or praise in your everyday music? How do you guys feel about that, Kimberly and LaShawna? Like when it comes to music and, you know, secular music, including spirituality or talking about mental health?
Well, I'm open to meeting people where they are, right? I love how she, how Bernadette Joy just introduced, Bernadette Joy, right? Okay, how she introduced Kendrick Lamar, right? Because I love it as well. It's a whole, like, music therapy, right, where people get extra training just to do music therapy. But you said something earlier, Alexandria, when you talked about your experience in the church and even just crying, right? Mm-hmm. And people don't understand how, you know, screaming, it's scream therapy, you know, how it releases, you know, the endorphins in the brain, right, and all of that. So as an EMDR therapist, I teach people how to recognize how trauma is stored in the body. And so I think music, dancing, all of that is a part of assisting in that release or opening that release valve.
Same here, utilizing music and being able to create that non-judgment zone. Mm-hmm. You know, as we speak about meeting clients, meeting individuals where they are, not saying, oh, well, you know what, if you're listening to this secular music, then you don't have any spiritual connection. Because as Bernadette Joy and LaShawna pointed out, that's not true. Two things can coexist at the same time. Within myself, also, I'm utilizing techniques such as art therapy. You know, when we're talking about that spiritual connection, you'll hear us use terms and teach coping skills alongside of mindfulness and, you know, sometimes meditation type techniques. Well, for many people, we're able to make that linkage because mindfulness is a form of prayer, mm-hmm, for them. So being able to make those connections so that we can offer the best that we have in order to help bring out the best in someone else.
Can I add like an example? So I grew up in the Catholic faith, and Catholicism goes back to Africa. A lot of people don't know that, and we all know the song "Kumbaya," the camp song that people sing at, mm-hmm, you know, campgrounds. Well, I did some research and I found out that "Kumbaya" came from Africa in Catholicism, and it actually means "Lord, I need you now." Mm. And that it was a slap in the face to the Catholic community when they made it into like a camp song. Mm-hmm. So for me personally, when I need the Lord, I'm like, "Kumbaya, my Lord, kumbaya." So a lot of people don't know those type of things. You know, it's not a camp song originally. It came from Catholicism and spirituality.
There is definitely a lot of that. And I definitely appreciate you guys sharing like these experiences and perspectives today. I hope we can continue this conversation. I'm so glad to meet with people that are having this because as we know that, you know, our healing is layered, our response has to be as well informed and clinically sound too. So I am glad to know that you ladies are being that solution to our Black health epidemics. So I'm thankful for you, Kimberly, LaShawna, and even State Rep White, who joined us today, and Bernadette, for lending your expertise as well as tuning in with us today for A Moment of Truth. Thank you to our listeners, and take care of yourselves, family.
You do the same.
Thanks. Thank you.
The Local Thread is a production of WGTE Public Media. Episodes can be heard weeknights at 7 on FM 91 or anytime at WGTE.org. The views and opinions expressed in the local thread are those of the hosts of the program and its guests. They do not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of WGTE Public Media.